We need to recapture.
When you turn on the tape, that's when we won't.
Yeah, exactly. But there's no reason to think about it, because I'll just delete it unless we have one of those moments like, hey, what was that great insight you had 5 minutes ago? I can't remember.
Okay, let's go to two.
Well, wait a second. I was going to make a follow-up clarification on number one. See, the reason I'm struggling with the difference between a proposition and a subjective assertion is, let's take the atheist's materialist's view of the world. Well, then I'm going to suggest that, and let's say before man has evolved, then I'm going to suggest that the notion of propositions attached to or mirroring facts is meaningless. What do you mean this is propositions?
Well, but you can't.
But what they want to say is, well, let's bracket that question for the moment.
Right.
And let's just say that whatever facts are there, there's these propositions that model that, which are the assertion of what the fact is. But I'm going to say, well, what do you mean the assertion of, or the model of, or... I mean, all of these terms imply mind. So, I mean, I'm willing to bracket it as long as...
Well,
there's an understanding
sense,
that...
Well, in one sense, that's what Craig is... I mean, that's what Wittgenstein's after here. He's,
exactly.
He's given his picture theory to account for that type of thing.
But the picture theory has to be more than just, oh yeah, now a mind has evolved that somehow can attach to all these propositions that were just kind of hanging out there all along, I think. At least that's going to be my thesis.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the big problem in Frege, from a non-Christian point of view. Because he is, despite his kind of atomistic views, he is very, very Fregean here.
Oh, you mean with Wittgenstein?
Wittgenstein, yeah.
Oh, I thought you said Fregean.
He is very Fregean.
No, I thought you said the problem with Frege's view.
Well, the problem with Frege's view, and by... You know, therefore the problem with Wittgenstein's view is, one of them is precisely that. I mean, how do you get to these propositions? I mean, it's not just, I mean, it's, how do you get in contact with them? And what are these, I mean, how does our language, you know, so we evolve a language, but how does this language get in contact with these things?
Well, it's not just that. That's part of it. But I mean, would you grant that this is a there's a duality that's being proposed here between the, let's say, crudely, let's just say the material thing and the description or proposition of that thing that is either true or false to the extent that it corresponds. So, in other words, you have a one-to-one mapping of all of these facts out there and the proposition that is either true or false that corresponds with the fact either being the case or not being the case. So it seems like there's a duality there.
Well, are you saying why is there a proposition and a fact? Why are they separate things?
They seem to carry one another. You can't have one without the other.
Right.
So they're correlative.
The propositions are linguistic things and facts.
Not if there's no linguistic producing entity. You know, unless you're just saying it's like a potentiality waiting to be actualized. And then, lo and behold, man evolves and has a mind. Now the proposition side of that duality is finally actualized, even though it wasn't there. So you have the electron, and then you have the proposition that says there is an electron, A. There's an electron, B. And there's a force between A and B described by this law. This whole nested world, right, of propositions which describe the facts. finally. But I'm suggesting that, well, why would you suppose that there's such a thing as this corresponding world of propositions, apart from a mind, or being aligned? So are they saying that once you have a mind and you backfill the universe, suddenly it kind of takes on this dual reflective nature?
Well, what I want to figure out in the early discussion is what work is the fact versus the proposition doing? I mean, if the fact is just something that's non-linguistic that exists, and a proposition comes into existence when there are minds, then what really is the Well, I think what Wittgenstein is saying is that there are these facts, no matter what, mind-independent things, and that the propositions are... Yeah, maybe he's not a Frege-ian here. Maybe he doesn't think the propositions come into existence.
Well, we'll probably find that out as we unpack more and more of the Tractatus, but I just want to make sure I understand the starting terminology, because that's going to be crucial. But then also on the 1.21, I want to challenge that a bit. Each item can be the case or not be the case while everything else remains the same. Is that really the case? I mean, let's say one of the facts is the law of gravitation. Would that be a fair thing to say?
No, I don't think so.
That's too complicated? Because it's gonna come down to atomic facts eventually.
I mean, that would be a fact in one sense, but
it's non-atomic, though.
Right.
But Wittgenstein himself constantly refused to give an example of an atomic proposition, I'm led to understand. But, I mean, was he even unwilling to give a heuristic? I mean, like, say you buy modern physics, I mean, would he be willing to say that a nucleus is composed of protons and neutrons? Is that getting close to an atomic fact? I mean, no pun intended on atomic, but... Or that there are two elementary particles that experience a force of repulsion? Is that an atomic fact? Is that getting close, at least, to what might be an atomic fact?
No, I don't think it's below. I think he's... would take a more empiricist line on an atomic fact. It's not the... It'd be more the sensory experience would be closer to the atomic fact.
So I see blue when I look at that book over there. Oh, is this thing flaming down now? Automatically?
Yeah, after a few minutes.
Yeah, I wish I could find out how to get into the BIOS and change that. So far it hasn't let me, though. When I hit F8, it just says, okay, I'm going to go and boot up anyway.
Oh, really?
You know. It doesn't say that, it just does it.
Right.
But, I mean, so I'm feeling hardness. What would the atomic fact be? The hardness? And then my statement, I'm feeling that hardness, is a reflective proposition that could be the case, or that's true, but it need not be true, and the world would say the same.
Well, let's go on and then see if we can...
Backfill?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, what did Anscombe say about these things?
Well, I don't remember.
Well, you look at... I have Anscombe, too. Look at Mills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is somewhat relevant. She says, talking about names can be made clear by elucidations, by sentences containing them spoken to someone who's acquainted with the object that they stand for. An obvious example of a name might seem to be the word red, uttered in a sentence, perhaps red patch here, in the presence of someone who is contemplating the red patch and who may be supposed to have acquaintance with the object designated by the word red. And red patch here would seem to be a candidate for being a simple or elementary observation statement. This suggests that the elementary propositions are not merely observation statements, but sense datum statements, as indeed they were taken to be both by many members of the Vienna Circle and for many years in Cambridge discussions. And I think it is quite possible that Wittgenstein had roughly this sort of thing rather vaguely in mind. But speaking of acquaintance, for that certainly seems the best rendering of kennen and its compounds where they occur in the Tractatus, very strongly suggests this. We immediately think of Russell's distinction between knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description. And she says something about Popper here. I do not believe that any other support for Popper's view of elementary propositions is to be found in the Tractatus, and this passage is rather slender support. In the first place, Wittgenstein does not state or even suggest that the proposition, which contains an elementary name, elucidates a name for a person acquainted with its reference, must be an elementary proposition. Indeed, quite generally, if elementary propositions are simple observation statements, it is very difficult to see how what Wittgenstein says here could possibly hold good for them. For any proposition which could possibly be called a simple observation statement, one could find another that would be incompatible with it and be precisely analogous to it logically. Therefore, whatever elementary proposition may be, they are not simple observation statements. And this accounts for the lack of reference to observation in all the remarks concerning elementary propositions, which would surely be very strange if Popper's interpretation were the correct one. But this is connected to the fact that there is hardly any epistemology in the Tractatus, and that Wittgenstein evidently did not think that epistemology had any bearing on the subject matter. We find epistemology put in its place in 4. He says, psychology is no nearer to philosophy than is any other natural science. The theory of knowledge is the philosophy of psychology.
Interesting.
Well, Mounce's comment might be more brief and to the point, perhaps. He says, quote, each item can be the case or not the case while everything else remains the same, unquote. This might strike some people as a denial of determinism. What is the case is quite undetermined by something else as being the case.
Read the first part of it.
He's just quoting Wittgenstein.
No, he wasn't. Read that again.
Each item can be the case or not the case.
Well, okay, but he's translating...
Well, that's the same as this translation that's given. He quotes it verbatim as to this translation.
Oh, okay, I see.
Of 121.
But the item is the...
Each item of fact, which we determined as a fact. We exegeted that. Let's take that as a given.
Okay.
Then Mounts. This, i.e. 121... might strike some people as a denial of determinism. What is the case is quite undetermined by something else as being the case. But this is not at all what Wittgenstein means. What he means is that something's being the case is not determined by something else's being the case as a matter of logic. The sense in which things necessarily occur is not that of logical necessity. This indeed is another way of saying that logic does not determine what is the case. Nevertheless, there is a connection between logic and the facts, because, as Wittgenstein says it at 113, it is the facts in logical space which constitute the world. But what is logical space? To understand this is also to understand why the world is the totality of facts, not of things. Let us consider propositions 2 through, etc. So then he moves on to the first several of number 2. Now here's next, his next pericope includes the first four statements of chapter 2.
Smelses, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so an atomic fact is a combination of objects, entities, things, etc. Or entities and things.
Well, you skipped number 2, didn't you?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. What is the case, the fact, that the existence of atomic facts?
This translation says the existence of states of affairs. So what yours calls atomic fact is what this one calls states of affairs?
Yeah, then the word is Sachverhalten.
Sachverhalten, okay, good.
So that's more literally states of affairs.
Sachverhalten is the word that's either states of affairs or atomic facts?
Yeah. Okay, so 121. A fact can either be the case or not be the case, and everything else remain the same. What is the case, the fact, is the existence of atomic facts. Okay, we need to...
Now, you know, Gordon Clark's going to pounce on that, but, and does, as I recall from Thales to Dewey, that he's defining his term with the use of the term. But that objection probably doesn't hold in the German. Is fact the Tatsache?
Two is hard to be exegeted in different ways. Going back, any fact can either be the case or not the case, and everything else be the remaining the same. So any fact could not be the case. What is the case, the fact, is the existence of atomic fact. Atomic fact. See, why does he put the fact in? Why does he need that in there? What is the case in the existence of atomic facts? And what work is that the Tatsache doing there? And why not just say, what is the case is the existence of atomic facts? Now, unless he just wants to mean, of course, what is the case is a fact.
Yeah, Sachverhalten seems to be liable to the same confusion between the subject side versus the objective side. I mean, Sachverhalten, if I was just trying to grope it, how to translate that, it would be something like the... The content held forth. But I think what he's saying by speaking of its existence, I think what he's saying is it's obtained that which is referred, the referent of the the matter held forth, if it exists, is the fact. So I don't think he's trying to do a lot of work with the sentence. I think he's just reiterating that the referent of our content held forth, if it exists, is an example of a fact, of what I'm calling a fact.
Yeah, but it's still a fact if it doesn't exist. Yeah, I mean, I don't... Under your reading, it's not doing any work, but more than that, it would be confusing.
Well, okay, not that that's a fact, but that that's a fact which is the case. Some facts are not the case.
Right.
But if it's by a fact being the case, I mean that the content held forth, the referent of the content held forth is, in fact exists. When that is the case, then I say that this is a fact which is the case. Why don't we take that tentatively and move on for the next three lines.
An atomic fact is a combination of objects, Zach and Dingen, it is essential to a thing that it can in this thing. It is essential to a thing that it can be a constituent part of an atomic fact.
Okay, so far he said that to be a state of affairs or atomic fact, or Zach for help, you must have more than one thing. Hence the combination of things, right? 201?
Right.
You must have more than one. And given that insight, given that relational insight, it is therefore essential to things that they are possible constituents
right.
of that combination. So in other words, I think what he's saying there is that to speak of an electron, an elementary particle, you hypothesize an elementary particle, however, it doesn't interact with the universe in any way. It doesn't create a sense datum, it doesn't create repulsion or attraction with any other thing, it's invisible, it doesn't reflect light. Wittgenstein is saying, well, that would be excluded from my ontology.
Right.
That's not part of our universe. Therefore, it's of the essence of something that it is in combination with some other thing, such that in that combination, it's going to comprise a fact which is reflected in our Zach für Held.
Right, and that clears up our earlier question about what's the relationship between a proposition and a fact. Well, a proposition doesn't have things as its constituents, whereas facts have things as their constituents. Propositions have names that refer to things.
But moreover, things cannot be, even though he's going to be talking about atomic facts, he's excluding the idea that that might be a something that cannot be in relation to any other thing.
Right.
A world must be of things that are related.
In logic, nothing is accidental. If a thing can occur in an atomic fact, the possibility of that atomic fact must already be prejudged in the thing.
Now, here the translation, instead of saying prejudged, it says the possibility must be written into the thing itself. What's the German on that one?
So, don't must be New Lichkeit des Gottesfeldes in den bereits prejudiziert sein. I guess the
prejudiziert, so that your translation is a little more literal as far as prejudiziert. However, sometimes I think a more dynamic translation could be better. Even though written into the thing seems like a metaphor that doesn't carry any weight in a sense that almost does capture it maybe in a way that prejudge doesn't.
Well, when you read yours, I would, my guess would be that yours would be the more literal rendering.
Yeah, even though prejudiziert, it seems like at least just from a lexicographical sense, yours seems more literal. In any case, I think by prejudge or prejudiziert, he's simply reiterating the fact that it's essential to. And by saying it's prejudiciert, he's again tying that into the subjective side, that therefore our atomic proposition must presuppose that aspect of what a fact must be, namely that it relates, but that logically it can relate. Let's see. Well, let's go back to the first phrase, that in logic nothing is accidental. Is that similar to what yours says?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that what yours says?
Yeah. But now, surely he's not saying that in an Aristotelian sense, though, is he?
No.
When he says accidental. In other words, he's not saying that all relationships are essential in their actual, in the relation that they actually occur, because that would seem to contradict his earlier statement.
No.
But then what is he denying by saying that nothing is accidental?
Well, it comes after the colon, but it doesn't seem to... It would seem to look a bit easier to understand without that. The antecedent phrase.
I mean, I'm almost wanting to say that he really wants to say the opposite of that. I mean, it seems like he really wants to say that the actual, or the fact that is the case, is accidental so far as anything that logic could have said about it, other than the fact that it must have certain qualities such as relation to another object. So any object must be related to another object to count as part of our world. But what that relationship is, it is in fact accidental, I think he should be saying.
Well, let's read. Everything can occur in an atomic fact. The possibility of that atomic fact must already be prejudged in the thing.
I think only saying there, I mean, what I would tentatively propose is that he's just highlighting that this one insight that a thing must be related to another thing, and that alone is not accidental because it's presupposed in the very nature of speaking of a fact.
So what you're saying is that he's
recapitulating.
Yeah, not only recapitulating, but saying that this, when he's saying in logic nothing is accidental, meaning that this one thing is not accidental. This is the one thing that logic does tell us.
Right, but everything else specific that you could say about the state of affairs will prove to be accidental. Because you have to be able to vary the logical space. Anything must be able to be the case while everything else stays the same, he said at the end of chapter 1. Which would imply that logically it is accidental. What the state of affairs proves to be the case is accidental from a logical standpoint.
Well, you said Malice then chimes in at this point.
I think you need one more curtain. To illustrate this, consider the propositions Socrates is fat and Plato is thin. These, we shall suppose, represent states of affairs. These states of affairs hold...
That's what he's using for atomic fat.
Yeah. These states of affairs hold in the world. But notice that they might not have done so. Socrates might have been thin and Plato fat. Now what this shows is that states of affairs are complex, for we can imagine them rearranged, the elements appearing in combinations different from those in which they actually appear. But in logic, says Wittgenstein at 2.012, nothing is accidental. If a thing can occur in a state of affairs, the possibility of the state of affairs must be written into the thing itself. Thus it is written into Socrates and into Plato that each can be fat and thin, he says, but I think he means fat or thin. There is a range of possible state of affairs into which Socrates...
No, each can be fat and each can be thin.
Okay. Parse it that way. There is a range of possible state of affairs into which Socrates and Plato fit. Which of these states of affairs are actual is not a matter of logic, but it is a matter of logic which states of affairs are possible. Whether Socrates is fat or thin is a matter of fact, but it is a matter of logic that he can be either one or the other. I think that's helpful. One may be reminded here of Frege's notion of a function.
Yeah, but the problem with Mounts is there's always something else going on in Wittgenstein, and that if that's all he's saying, then...
Well, he goes on. One may be reminded here of Frege's notion of a function. Frege would analyze Socrates as fat into a function X is fat for which Socrates supplies the argument. One might put it by saying that Socrates fits the function X is fat. Now this, in a way, expresses what Wittgenstein has in mind when he says the world is the totality of facts, not of things. To say that the world is a totality of things would be to leave out that things fit together. Things exist only in facts. Moreover, which facts a thing can fit into is predetermined. It is written into the nature of the thing. That is why it is not things but facts, and not just facts but facts in logical space, that constitute the world. At 2.0131, Wittgenstein gives further examples of logical space or logical form. Quote, a speck in the visual field, though it need not be red, must have some color. It is, so to speak, surrounded by color space. Notes must have some pitch, the objects of the sense of touch some degree of hardness, and so on. Logical form shows itself in that a speck must have some color, a note some pitch, whereas a speck cannot have a pitch nor a note a color. Specks fit with colors, notes with pitches. But there is a point here of great importance. It is important not to think of logical space or form as a special kind of fact, some kind of universal cement that holds things together. Consider again Socrates as fat. X is fat is the function into which the argument Socrates fits. Now suppose someone were to ask, what makes it fit? One might be tempted to reply, logical form. But this would be very misleading because it would suggest that logical form is some extra fact binding things together. Logical form, however, cannot be stated in this way. Rather, it shows itself in things fitting together. We must remember that logic does not determine any fact, but only what combinations are possible. What Cho's logical form is that Socrates is fat is a possible combination, whereas fatness of Socrates, for example, is not. Wittgenstein expresses this point at 203 by means of a brilliant image. In a state of affairs, objects fit into one in another like links in a chain. A state of affairs, like a chain, is not just a collection, but a collection that holds together in a determinate way. But what holds together the links of a chain? Nothing, except they're fitting into one another. Their fitting into one another is how they hold together. The same point applies to the combination of objects in a state of affairs. That they hold together in a determinate way shows something about their logical form. But logical form is not a further fact about them, that which holds them together.
Well, that's helpful. So he's pressing on beyond where we are.
Well, he only had cited what we read so far, but he keeps forward referring. The world, then, is the totality of facts in logical space, or again, it is the totality of states of affairs which are made up of objects fitting together in a determinate way. These are the conclusions of the first few pages of the Tractatus. But what kind of conclusions are they? They are statements about the world, but as we shall see later, they are not in any natural sense empirical propositions. They are statements about how the world has to be if there is to be sense, if there are to be propositions. We shall see this more clearly if we look closely for a moment at Wittgenstein's notion of an object. So far we have treated Socrates as if it were the name of an object. This will do for the purpose of a first rough exposition, but it needs to be qualified. Neither persons nor indeed the physical objects of ordinary experience will serve as objects in Wittgenstein's sense. Thus at 202, Wittgenstein says, objects are simple. The objects of ordinary experience are complex. A chair, for example. So to grasp the name chair, one must first understand, it would seem, the simpler names back, seat, legs. Moreover, these simpler names are not themselves simple. They too can be further described, and therefore depend for their sense on names which are simpler still. The objects of which Wittgenstein speaks, however, are absolutely simple. The names for these objects can be grasped immediately, for to do so does not depend on grasping names that are simpler still. What then would be an example of such objects? Wittgenstein was never able to provide such an example. At the time of the Tractatus, Wittgenstein believed that we could be sure that such objects exist, but that we cannot say what they are. This might strike some as suspicious, and Wittgenstein himself later came to believe that this whole notion of simple objects was radically confused. Why then was he inclined to speak of them in the Tractatus? Because he felt that they were a requirement of language. We can see what he had in mind if we go back for a moment to our example of chair. In order to grasp the meaning of chair, we said, one has to grasp the meaning of simpler words such as leg, seat, etc. But now, this surely is not a process that can go on forever. If there are not some words that stand directly for objects, we shall never grasp a name at all. At some point, there must be objects, and therefore names, which are absolutely simple. Otherwise, there would be no contact between language and the world, and nothing could be said. This is what Wittgenstein has in mind at 202.11, where he says that if there were no simple objects, then whether a proposition that had sense would depend on whether another proposition was true. That would be the coherentist view, right?
Mm-hmm.
What he means is that if we could not be sure that words stood for objects, we could never understand a given proposition until we had another proposition which assured us that the names of the first really did stand for objects. But this is an impossible state of affairs. For whether a proposition has sense cannot be a contingent matter. What is contingent is whether it is true or false. But in order to be true or false, a proposition must already possess a sense. The sense of a proposition, in short, must be independent of whether it is in fact true or false. Frege, right?
Right.
Consequently, there must be a contact between language and the world which is prior to the truth or falsity of what we say. Such a contact is to be found in the relationship between a simple name and a simple object, the relationship being such that the name just stands for the object independently of description. What Wittgenstein is suggesting then is that the nature of language can be understood only if we understand also that the world is not simply a collection of things, but is a totality of states of affairs which are made up of objects fitting together in a determinate way. But how then is language related to the world? Wittgenstein suggests that the propositions of language picture or represent the world, and it is this famous comparison between a proposition and a picture that we must now consider in greater detail. That goes to chapter 2. And then he goes to 2.1 and does it through 2.15.
Well, we did pick up a... Okay, so let's... So, yeah, so he...
Oh, he skipped over several pages.
Yeah, he covered a lot of stuff.
He just... he must be just excerpting in the... His citations before each section.
Okay, well, let's with that background, let's continue reading then.
Yeah.
It would, so to speak, appear to be an accident when to a thing that could exist alone on its own account, subsequently a state of affairs could be made to fit.
Where's my tamper? Here.
Read yours. This is the syntax of this translation. It's pretty ugly.
Now, we read, you're talking about
2.0121.
Okay. This is, in mine, this is a whole paragraph long. It's not just one sentence. Right?
No, yes. It's three paragraphs.
Okay.
But the first one.
The first sentence.
Right.
It would seem to be a sort of accident if it turned out that a situation would fit a thing that could already exist entirely on its own. Let me continue. If things can occur in states of affairs, this possibility must be in them from the beginning. Nothing in the province of logic can be merely possible. Logic deals with every possibility, and all possibilities are its facts. Just as we are quite unable to imagine spatial objects outside space, or temporal objects outside time, so too there is no object that we can imagine excluded from the possibility of combining with others. If I can imagine objects combined in states of affairs, I cannot imagine them excluded from the possibility of such combinations.
Right. Some form of a transcendental argument. This the thing is independent insofar as it can occur in all possible circumstances. But this form of independence is a form of connection with the atomic fact, a form of dependence. It is impossible for words to occur in two different ways, alone and in the proposition. Right, so this is just reiterating what he says before, clarifying. So things are independent metaphysically, but as constituents of facts, they're dependent. They must have possibility of connection with other facts. If I know an object, then I also know all the possibilities of its occurrence in atomic facts.
Is there more on 0123?
Yeah, each possibility must lie in the nature of the object. A new possibility cannot subsequently be found.
Mine says a new possibility cannot be discovered later.
So when he says, that must be exhaustive knowledge of it then.
Yeah, I think that what he must mean is that to really say that you know an object would mean that you had unpacked all of its possible occurrences. But the last sentence seems to say that, well, it says it cannot be discovered later. Is it entdeckt? Kann er später entdeckt sein?
No. Es kann nicht nachträglich. Traglich?
Is it with an A umlaut? Nachträglich.
Träglich. Eine neue Möglichkeit gefunden werden.
That seems to be a little bit overly harsh, though, right? Because,
well, not if you know, if he means by knowledge, complete knowledge of it.
But then by speaking of something discovered later, or nachträglich, eine Möglichkeit, what's the verb? I need a verb, Senator. I need a verb. In that last sentence?
Gefunden.
Oh, gefunden. Okay, so be found or discovered. It's fine. That seems to be more of an epistemological assertion.
Well, right, but he's in the context of an epistemological assertion. Condition is I know the object. So it's something like Cartesian knowledge. I mean, or exhaustive knowledge of it. So if you know all about an object, then a new possibility cannot subsequently be found. You can discover things about an object by its what is the case, but you can't discover a new possibility.
Yeah, right, but I mean, if he's willing to say that we ever do know an object.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's a rabbit trail. I think he's saying
it's just the pure conditional, is what he's saying?
Yeah. He's not even defining that is no. I mean, to know is to have the knowledge of all possibilities. He's just saying that's, in this robust sense of know, it's to know all possibilities. In order to know an object, I must know not its external, but all its internal qualities.
Okay, let's see if we know what that means. Is that a standard usage in metaphysics? The external and internal properties?
No. Well, yeah, in the more idealist setting. Internal properties.
Well, this is a qualification of the previous sentence, because it's indented one more. Mm-hmm. So on your...
He's giving the condition of what it means to know an object. So you must know that thing's internal qualities, and knowing its internal qualities, know what kind of possible relations it can enter into.
Well, I think it's more abstract. I mean, I think that he must mean by internal quality, he must just mean the full range of its possible relationships. whereas the external property must mean something that would be discovered empirically, let's say. So that, for example, you would use my, to go, always go back to my...
Wasn't that what I just said? All the possible common relations that can enter into?
I suppose. But I think the internal is that as a... as a logical. In other words, going back to my standard hobby horse of the physics elementary particles, it seems like the internal property, he seems to be saying the internal property of an electron is that it could relate to anything, any other object in the universe. Theoretically. In terms of pure logical possibility. Now, empirically, we find that, let's say, an electron does not ever interact with a neutron, let's say. So that seems to exclude some possibilities that were included in its internal qualities. But that wouldn't bother Wittgenstein, I don't think, because he's making this distinction. He's saying that its internal quality is simply that abstract possibility.
Right, the logical space.
Yeah. Now we find out, as a matter of fact, it can't interact with some things, like say neutrons. But that's an external property that would be to be discovered.
If all objects are given, then thereby are all possible atomic facts also given.
That seems to follow from what you said before.
This is a higher level now, than the last two ones. Last two. If all objects are given, this is the previous one was 1, 2, 4.
We should be at 0, 1, 13. 0, 13 now.
Right, I'm trying to see. But okay, two back is 0, 1, 2, 3. Then 0, 1, 2, 3, 1.
Well, 0, 12 would be at the same level. Way back where it says in logic nothing is accidental.
Right. Oh yeah. But
now we're at the same level as that, moving on to 0.13.
That's helpful. Okay. Everything is, as it were, in a space of possible atomic facts. I can think of the space as empty, but not of the thing without the space. Right.
Okay.
That seems to be, maybe this is a bunny rabbit trail, but it seems to be a bit Newtonian. Everything is, in the words, a space in a space of possible atomic facts. I can think of the space as empty. So the logical space, now, Mounce, I think, touched on this, that he said that this passage here made it sound like logical space is a fact, separate, a different type of fact. But that's not what Wittgenstein meant.
Is he saying, to use Mounce's example, is he saying that there are logical spaces such as would be filled by the statement fatness of Socrates that sort of self-destruct and that thus are empty? But that once you have an actual object, like Socrates himself, it carries with them this kind of manifold of possible relationships. Or is he saying that you can imagine a universe without a Socrates at all?
Well, that's what he seems to be saying. I mean, he seems to be saying you can imagine a universe without anything at all. I can think of this space as empty. And that this is a space of possible atomic facts, but not of the thing without the space. Yeah, I get the second part, but why would he say I can think of the space of possible atomic facts as empty?
Would it be more clear if he had said subspace?
Well, but I don't. Yeah, that would be clear, but is that what he's? I mean, does he want to say that we can think of the universe without any facts? It would be nonsense.
No, because I'm thinking if you take the phrase a space of possible states of affairs, if you said that, I'm thinking of the space of a space of possible states of affairs would be the universe of unicorns.
Or a universe in which there are unicorns.
Yeah, a universe in which there are unicorns. I guess the question is whether an empty space means simply a particular space. Possible configuration that's not the case, that's false. Is that the same as saying it's empty? Sort of like an empty set. The set of unicorns.
Oh, yeah, I think that's right. Yes, that's right. Everything is, as it were, in a space of possible atomic facts. I can think of the space as empty. Right, that's right. But not of the thing without the space.
So you can't have a unicorn that doesn't carry the space of possible relationships with it, but you can think of the set of unicorns, or the universe that has the set of unicorns, as being an empty
set. Right. A spatial object must lie in an infinite space. A point in space is an argument place.
Now here I don't think he means a Newtonian infinite space. In other words, I don't think he means outer space extending infinitely. I don't think.
Well, right, but it may have implications to it for it. What he's meaning, I believe, is you think of any object, and you can think of any another object being in relation with that, and then another one in relation to that, etc. There's no end, and so therefore there's no delimitation to that, to the space. So therefore it must be an infinite space. Now, I mean, he may be making a Kantian point from that we must think of the world as Newtonian, space as Newtonian.
Would he accept, I mean, would it fit this description if you said that...
Am I out of matches, Jimmy?
We are not out of matches.
No. Go ahead. It's that one right here. But first of all, let's get clear if that's what he's saying, right? That if you conceive of any object in space, then you can conceive of any other object in relation to it, etc., etc., and therefore it makes no sense to... You can't possibly delimit that space.
Well, what if you went the other direction? I mean, because in the parenthesis he talks about a spatial point. So, suppose you took two spatial points, A and B, and then kind of do a Zeno's paradox kind of thing. You can always find a midpoint between A and B. You can find a midpoint between that point and A, etc. There's sort of an infinity there, mm-hmm. right? Yet the line segment between A and B is finite from a Newtonian point of view. In other words, it's not yet infinite the way Newton meant infinite. Infinitely extended. But yet there's an infinity of the spatial manifold in the sense that these points can never be...
Because if you think of the relation to the right of, then any object can be in a any object can have something to the right of it. So So I think it goes both ways.
But I mean, if you take sort of the general theory of relativity of the curved space that is finite in one sense, in the sense that, you know, a rocket ship going out somehow would kind of eventually wrap back around and come back where it started from. Would that be a refutation of Wittgenstein's point here necessarily? Because even in that view, you'd always have something forward of the spaceship and behind it, to the right and to the left, and yet you wouldn't be kind of Newtonian in the sense of saying that, yeah, you could just keep going and going and going and going, sort of in that
intuitive sense. Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
In other words, I hope that we're not committed. He's not going to be that Wittgenstein's system is not going to be refuted by showing that Newton's space is wrong. And I don't think it would be. Even if he was thinking that that was an implication, I don't think it's a necessary one. Because he was probably writing this before Einstein came out with the general theory. About the same time, actually.
No doubt wouldn't be aware of it.
Right.
A speck in a visual field need not be red, but it must have a color. It has, so to speak, color around it. Its tone must have a pitch, the object, the sense of touch, a hardness, etc.
Yeah, Mounts had cited that in advance, that very sentence.
Objects contain the possibility of all states and affairs.
The possibility of its occurring in states of affairs is the form of the object. Interesting. So the color, the form, the color form of an object is that it has some color, and that is its form.
Right.
But now, wouldn't Aristotle, for example, or Plato, the Greeks, some of the Greeks say that the form of an apple includes being red or green, let's say, that it couldn't just be any color. It's not the sum of all logical possibilities of having some color, but rather that some colors are part of the form of some objects. Like the golden bough, part of its form is to be gold. Maybe he would say that's just a tautology and not meaningful. Later on. Because later on he is going to say that tautologies don't say anything about the world.
Well, whether that's what Plato or Aristotle would say is, I don't think he's going to touch on Wittgenstein here.
Well, yeah, but it's helpful to know, like, where he's departing from Plato. I mean, it helps to challenge one's understanding to know, like, yeah, he departs from Plato here, let's say. Mm-hmm. The form of an apple for Plato may not have included just any color, that it has some color, but rather that maybe it has some range of colors. Whereas Wittgenstein's going to say, no, its form is that if it's an extended object, it has some color, I think. Would you agree that that's probably where Wittgenstein's going by defining form in this way? It's broader than Plato's form? More abstract?
But
I mean, he wants to pick up on the form-matter distinction, apparently. But he's broadening its earlier understanding from Plato. Even more Platonic than Plato. I seem like I must be getting something stuck in this stem.
Well, I think the thing in the Plato, the Greek thought here is, for the example of the apple, well, Wittgenstein would say perhaps that may in fact be, redness may be in fact part of the form of, I don't think you necessarily would say it couldn't be, that would deny that that's not part of the form, but that would be simply because it wouldn't be an atomic fact.
Right. In other words, I think maybe he would criticize this whole inquiry by saying, you're already way too complex. A chair has a seat, back, and legs. Those are themselves spatial objects, as well as maybe other form, have other forms. And you keep getting back to a raw atomic object, which, if it's spatial, has the possibility of color and has the possibility of some shape, let's say. And so finally, there is a form of the raw constituent. Not that everything necessarily is spatial and has color. A tone, for example, is a different object. But that has its possibility. So when you say, well, a symphony has to have certain qualities of harmony and so forth, which seems to exclude its possibilities, Wittgenstein would probably say at that point, no, no, you're already way too complicated. You've built up way beyond from the thing I'm talking about.
Right, and I think he checks that temptation the next line, which says the object is simple. So when you use the example of an apple, well, you're not thinking of the right types of things. I mean, you could use apples for examples if they serve the purpose, but when you try to exclude certain things or try to force something in it, that would be too broad of an example, too complicated of an example.
But if by the next sentence he means all objects are simple, then he would have to say that an apple is not an object.
Well, I think what he means is, yeah, it's bordered on a tautology, but simple objects are simple. Or the correspondent, if you can call it an atomic object, are simple. Call it an atomic object. I mean, he's certainly going to allow for complex facts and therefore complex objects.
In fact, the next sentence, I guess, addresses that.
Every statement about complexes can be analyzed into a statement about their constituent parts, and into those propositions which completely describe the complexes. It's interesting that he brings up propositions here. This is the first time he introduces a proposition. Any statement about complexes can be analyzed into a statement about their constituent parts. Yeah, I wonder why he seems to avoid, he says complex is the German is, I don't know how to pronounce it, complexe, K-O-M-P-L-E-X-E.
Yeah, complexe.
But he doesn't say, he avoids saying complex objects.
Well, my translation says every statement about complexes can be resolved.
Mm-hmm. That's what mine says, can be analyzed. Every statement about complexes.
Well, I mean, so far...
I mean, I'm just wondering if this is just being... trying not to be wordy, but when he's saying every statement about complexes, is he talking about complex objects, or is he just doesn't want to talk about complex objects?
Well, if you combine it with 202, I really think that we're forced into saying that on his definition of terms, the apple is not an object, it's a complex. And same with the chair.
So you don't think, you think it's, then it's not a complex. So you're thinking that he's avoiding it for the reason that he doesn't believe they're objects. They're complexes.
Right. As 202 says, objects are simple. Is the word Gegen, is it the Gegenstand there or Dinge?
Gegenstand.
So objects are different from things.
Well, they're all, well, that remains to be seen. He doesn't. Unless you, so you think complexes and things are the same thing?
No, I think things are probably closer to objects. Because back in one point, one, he says the world is the totality of facts, not of things. So there the things seem to be functioning as kind of the unrelated brute material that one naively thought the world was composed of.
Well, 201, he says, an object, an atomic fact is a combination of objects. And then he glosses, parenthetically says, Zach and Dingen. So objects are entities, things. So a complex is not a thing.
Well, 201, the parenthesis in 201 almost seems to identify things and objects.
Right.
And 202 says the objects are simple, therefore things are simple.
Right.
And therefore the things...
Things of the complexes are not things.
Some things that we thought were things are not things by this way of analyzing things.
Right, I'm just trying to get his vocabulary right. Cause then you, so it's not like there's objects and things and complexes, there's... Objects slash things, and then there's complex states of affairs, which are analyzable down to the objects.
I can buy that, temporarily at least.
Objects form the substance of the world, therefore they cannot be compounded.
Now, did he have to introduce the word substance at this point?
Well, this is an argument, so he's basically arguing for what he stated at 202. So he's drawing the conclusion at 202.1 that the object is simple for the reason that objects form the substance of the world. Okay, so if objects form all the constituents of the world, they cannot be compounded. But how does that follow?
Well, that argument is explicated in the couple statements that follow.
Okay, so if the world has no substance, then whether a proposition has sense would depend on whether another proposition is true. It would then be impossible to form a picture of the world, true or false. It is clear that, however, different from the real one, an imagined world may be, it must have something, a form, in common with the real one. this fixed form consists of the objects. Well, as it stands, it's not a good argument, but combined with what he said before, going back at 2014, objects contain the possibility of all states of affairs. So if objects could be complex, then they couldn't contain the possibility of all states of affairs, namely simpler states of affairs, and therefore they must be simple. For the argument that he gives on 2021 following.
Well, I'm beginning to think that by substance he simply means that which cannot be broken down further, analyzed further.
Well, that would be 2021 would be tautologist then. I mean, granted, he believes that substance are objects that are simple, but I mean, if it's just a definition, then that wouldn't be interesting. I mean, if he's saying objects form substance, which are simple, the substance of the world, therefore they cannot be compound. Well, however we want to take his argument, what he's saying is clear. My take of the argument is the key is 2014. Because objects contain all the possibility of all states of affairs, if objects could be complex, then they couldn't contain all possible states of affairs. Therefore, they must be simple. It's interesting, I never knew this, but Donald Davidson really picks up on this line of thought in his some of his later work, especially about the conceivability or of Nia's arguments about, well, what about worlds of which we can't conceptualize? And he makes a different standpoint, is that's without meaning. I mean, you have to at least be able to map it out on our world in order to have any sense of what it is at all.
per 2.022.
Right.
So pretend like an apple is an atomic fact, even though we know that's not the case. And let's say all apples are red in our world. Yet you can imagine a world in which those apples were green. So that something which is in common is the apple as having a color.
Right. But you can't imagine a world in which an apple...
A colorless apple.
Right, or an apple is a tone, has a tone.
Tie it to the simplicity, though. I think it's like what Mounce was saying with this sort of an infinite regress. I mean, if you were going to take the complex of an apple and let everything be free, it may or may not be edible, it may or may not be soft, it may or may not be, have a color. You can't have a world unless it's finally going to boil down to some things that are givens, which are no longer analyzable at a more primitive level. And that, whatever those primitive things are that cannot be pushed any further back, by definition, he's saying that's substance. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that substance for him means, you know, the stuff that, the actual given stuff. Of the universe, which if you could give a name to it, it would not be drawable back in terms of being described in terms of other more basic propositions. Because if it were, if you could keep doing that, it would be an infinite regress. Although, if that's what he means, it's surprising that he wouldn't state it that way. If he's trying to avoid an infinite regress, why doesn't he say that he's trying to avoid an infinite regress? Kind of like those metaphysics books that we went through often talk about. I mean, if we tie it to those metaphysics books, substance differs from essence in that it's the stuff that is basic before you've discussed its essence. That is, its qualities and its relationships that are essential, that are necessary to it, or inseparable from it.
Yeah, 2023, he says, the fixed form consists of the objects. Okay, so back a little bit. So whether the world is real or an imagined one, it must have something, a form in common with the real world. So an imagined world must have a form in common with the real world. This fixed form consists of the objects. Okay, so... these symbols are in the real world and any possible world or any possibly imagined world. So whatever they are, whatever you think of, conceptualize, must contain those things.
Yeah, it sounds like he is making a similar point to what you described Davidson as saying. So in other words, any possible world must be built from combinations of this substance, which we already have in this world. Well, why don't we forge ahead?
But here he's tying the theory of meaning with his metaphysics, which is theologically objectionable.
How so?
Well, could there not have been another world created with other simple objects? Other objects?
Well, later on he's gonna say that God is not in the world. He's outside the world.
Well, and I guess another way of saying it, must God create the world with the exact same objects in Wittgenstein's sense?
Yeah, so if we take the medievalists' epistemology that distinguishes between types of minds, you know, angelic mind, human mind, divine mind, and others, categories they would allow for. It almost seems like he's, you know, if we were going to put this into a theological context, he would have to say that, well, I'm speaking of the created mind, the world of the created mind, and specifically the world that our created mind can possibly inhabit. I'm not speaking of the divine mind, because God is outside the world, so that which is possible to that mind...
Well, what about the interesting case of the angelic mind?
That's right. I mean, that's why the medievalists, I think, were astute to make that distinction. Because if we take, like, say, Klein's view of the two registers, and the angels can enter our world, but also dwell in the upper register, totally different world that doesn't intersect ours spatially or temporally, they would still be creaturely and yet have a different substance. They would have a world which, by Wittgenstein's terminology here, has a different field of possibility and substance, which is out of our world. We can't even say that that's possible, because it's not in our field of our logical field, so to speak. But in a sense, the logical field, again, to reinterpret Wittgenstein theologically, the logical field is really a subset of what is the divine, logically possible world. But right. Yet, for us to speak of such another world would not be possible, other than, say, by revelation. But, and even then, it would only be a reference, you know, a name given to something that we can't bring that into our field just by giving it a name. The angelic realm, for example. I mean, we would have to affirm the existence of the angelic realm without being able to unpack it or give it a place in our logical field.
Here and now. Although there's no a priori reason to think that we won't enter into.
That's right. So I'm wondering how Wittgenstein would... Here's where he still has one foot in the logical positivist's swamp, I think. Because even if we're... I mean, I think what he would have to say is that, well, if that is to happen, let's say, eschatologically, then we've wiped the slate clean. I mean, at that point, we...
Well, I think what he'd say is that's meaningless to even talk about that. lead basket.
But would he say it's totally meaningless, or just meaningless in terms of what we can do with our metaphysics and our epistemology, given our creaturely zits and leben?
Well, I think you'd say the former. That would be... But whether he's forced to say that is more interesting.
Right, right.
Okay, it goes to a sub-point. The substance of the world can only determine a form and not any material properties. For these are first presented by the propositions, first formed by the configuration of the objects. Right, so reiterating an earlier point he made, remember the way.
Well, my translation is not very clear at all. The last phrase of my translation says, only by the configuration of objects that they are produced.
That they are produced?
Well, it ties to the first part. It must mean, for it is only by means of propositions that he says, it is only by means of propositions that material properties are represented. That seems to be a mental statement. Only by the configuration of objects that they are produced. That seems to be a dangling, not quite sure how to parse that. Only by the configuration of objects that they are produced. That what are produced?
Erst durch die Konfiguration der Gegenstände gebildet.
Can I see that whole German thing for a second? It's 0231. Die Substanz der Welt kann nur eine Form und keine materiellen Eigenschaften bestimmen. Both your translation and mine italicizes can. Oh, I guess it is italicized. They italicize it in German by spacing the letters out. Die Substanz der Welt kann nur eine Form und keine materiellen Eigenschaften bestimmen. Denn dieser, that is the material properties, werden erst durch die Sätze dargestellt. Okay, at least I can figure out the syntax here. The material properties are only first presented by the propositions. These material properties are only built up by the configuration of objects. Okay, I think I get it. Yeah, I think the aorist could be translated not only by first, but perhaps better by only. As a matter of fact, mine does use only. Yours says first, which is the literal of aorist, but aorist can also have the force of only. So the material properties are only built up by the representing propositions. Material properties only by the configuration of the objects that are produced. And it's the configuration that is produced, not the objects. Okay, I guess I'm with that.
That's about a pen. I'm going to make it a little
go up here. Explain the syntax here. Okay, I got it. Now, the next sentence, and he says, this one says, in a manner of speaking, objects are colorless. But that's kind of elliptical, right? I mean, what he's really saying is, if they are extended spatial objects, let's say, They aren't colorless, but it's that their color is not specified. It could be this color or that color, or they're colorless as to form, but that they have a color is part of their form. But that's misleading to say that that's colorless. I think he's trying to be a little bit too elliptical here. Or gnomic, or
what is Farblos is of the German word for color was not Farb, but is there another sense of Farb?
Farba would be the noun thing by itself. I think it's color. Does your translation say color?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, colorless.
Because in O 131, he says, though it need not be red, it must have some color. O 232 would seem to take that, would seem to contradict that on one reading, but I think, therefore, he must only be meaning that it has some color, but not any particular color. Yet, until it's specified, until it's given. So its form is colorless only in the sense that it could be any color in the logical space. Would you agree with that?
Yes. But I don't know if that's what he's saying.
Well, what, isn't he forced to be saying that by his comment in O131?
Yeah, but why would he say, well, that would be an awkward way of saying it. Objects are without, why would not say, roughly speaking, objects are without specific form, I mean specific color.
My translation gives the first phrase as in a manner of speaking. Is that what yours says?
Mine says roughly speaking.
Was it Zotzenzagen?
Beilaufig is gesprochen.
That would have. I would have translated that something like temporarily speaking, or approximately, as a first cut.
Yeah, that will. The rendering of it is roughly speaking, then is probably not the best way to translate it. What was that translation say?
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah, your explanation makes more sense. But roughly speaking, I mean, in a manner of speaking, in this sense, then they don't have, they're without color. Namely, without a given color.
If two objects have the same logical form, the only distinction between them, apart from their external properties, is that they are different. Which is another way of saying that they're not identical. Which is another way of saying they're not the same object. I mean, I guess that's reasonable, right? I mean, when you translate that into symbolic logic, you need a logical constant, finally, for these two objects, A and B, capital A and capital B. A is some form. A belongs to some set, B belongs to the same set. Then how are A and B different? How do they differ from one another? Well, they differ because they differ. A is not the same as B. Yeah, that's going to require a little bit of more, isn't it? Because if A is not identical to B, then there's a discernible difference. And that would seem to
imply an external relation. Properties.
Which is why it says apart from their external properties, I guess. So if there were such a thing as two identical apples, but not identical, strictly identical, but two apples that are in every property identical, it's only by virtue of their external relationships that you can say that that A is not the same as B.
Right.
I guess that's all he's saying. This apple is here, this apple is here.
But he says apart from their external properties.
Right. So there is no distinction between them apart from their external properties. So there can't be any instantiation without bringing in their external relations. That's what he's saying.
No, I don't think so. Two objects of the same logical form are, apart from their external properties, only different from one another in that they are different.
Oh, whereas what I was implying was that they aren't different from each other Whereas he's saying they are different.
They are.
Even apart from their... Interesting.
So, there's two apples. And they don't differ from their external properties. But they're identical. The only way that they differ is that they differ. That seems a violation of Leibniz's law.
Yeah, this seems to be an assertion that we should delete from the Tractatus. Or he's trying to say something that we're not grasping from the way it's stated. I don't think this is a sustainable statement from the syntax.
Well, except for the fact that he starts off with two objects. That's the given. There are two objects of the same logical form.
Yeah, but isn't he kind of leapfrogging over the problem of individuation by suggesting that you can speak of two objects apart from their external relations, yet having the same form? In other words, it seems like maybe he's trying to leapfrog over the one-in-many problem here just by asserting it.
Well, the next paragraph he says, either a thing has properties which no other thing has, which no other has, and then one can distinguish it straightway from the others by description and refer to it, or, on the other hand, there are several things which have the totality of their properties in common, and then it is quite impossible to point to any of them. If the thing is not distinguished by anything, I cannot distinguish it, for otherwise it would be distinguished.
See, that makes a lot more sense, but that would almost be to show that his earlier statement is self-defeating. Yeah, I wonder if 233 is meant to be a reductio against saying that there's two objects that are the same in form, yet separate, unless you bring in their external properties.
It doesn't seem to be a reductio.
Well, 2331 makes sense, right?
Right.
And if we take that as the explication of the earlier 233, then we should interpret 233 in terms of our understanding of 2331.
So the only two objects, the same logical form, are differentiated from one another in that they are different. But since they cannot be differentiated, then it is impossible to point for it to either to any one of them. And therefore, two objects cannot have the same logical form.
Well, I think he's going to say that they can, but only when you drag in their external properties. In other words, external properties are the principle of individuation.
Read your 233.
It
says, you says it as a conditional, I think.
Yeah, if two objects have the same logical form, the only distinction between them, apart from their external properties, is that they are different. See, I'm thinking that that would make better sense if it was expressed modally. If there could be such a thing as two objects with the same logical form, apart from their external properties, the only thing that would be left would be that they are different, which is not saying anything about them. How can you say that they're different if they have the same logical form, but apart from their external properties? You can't. That's why I'm suggesting it has to be, it should be stated modally and as sort of the form of a reductio. Is the German more modal? It's 233.
Well, it says in order to know an object, I must not know its external, but its internal qualities. So its form, in other words.
Which sentence does it say that in?
That's back in 201231.
Oh, 231?
Mm-hmm. 01231.
Oh, 01231?
Right, 2.01231.
Right, but then he's going to have to say that it would seem like he's going to be forced to say that he can only know one object of any given class.
I think you're reading of this. I think you. Two objects of the same logical form are, apart from the internal properties, only differentiated from one another, and that they are different.
Yeah, but that seems too naive. I mean, we're trying to explain what it means to say two objects are different. Unless he's wanting to just say that's a primary.
Like, yeah, because he says here, apart from their external properties, but not apart from their internal properties. But if they have the same logical form, that means they have the same internal properties.
That's right.
Okay, well, I could buy that for now. In the German, it is two objects von der gleichen logischen Form sind. So it's not in the adjunctive. Ob ist sehen von ihren externen Eigenschaften von einander nur dadurch unterscheiden, dass sie verschieden sind.
Verschieden.
Verschieden. Verschieden. Is it
verschieden? Right? Is it IE?
IE,
yeah. Yeah, verschieden. Yeah, this seems to be a very unhappy sentence in his development. Unless he's going to make it more clear later.
Okay. Well, substance is what exists independently of what is the case. So it's all the contents of the forms of sensibility or is it form? It is form and content. Substance is form and content. But isn't the content the external relations? Space, time, and color, coloredness, are forms of objects. The word for content there is Inhalt. He is the form und Kindle, Inhalt. Well, I get 24, but then 25, substance is form and content. We really misread them before. We're misreading. I mean, isn't what is the case the content? Doesn't that provide the content? If substance provides both form and content, then it would also provide us with what is the case. But substance exists independently of what is the case. I don't understand 25. Obviously, he's drawn a different distinction between a form and matter. But what is content then? I mean, if it's the internal relations, then that's just another way of saying form. So what is the content? What is being added there? Substance is form and content. Well, what is the content? There's no clue that I can think of that tells us anything beyond that it's form. Unless he just simply means it's a substance is form in a thing. In other words, it's an object. It's a form and an object. In which case, that would change our reading of 2.3.3, which he said, because if that's the case, only different from one another in that they are different, namely different objects. The same logical form, but they're two different objects. That's because substances are both form and objects. So the identity criteria of objects are not simply same logical form, but sameness of objects as well. What's your take on 25? And it's and when he explains 25 and 25.1, he says space, time, and color are forms of objects. Well, I mean, I think that does explain it a bit. So the content is the objective nature of the substance.
My 25.1 adds a parenthesis after color.
Colorless.
Yeah, being colored.
Well, hear me out here. He says space, time, and color are forms of objects. But he says over here, going back to where we've already kind of settled on it preliminarily, when he says, roughly speaking, objects are colorless. So the color is the form that objects appear in or come in. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is objects are indeed colorless, but they come in forms that are colored, spatial, and temporal.
Well, I would take the word form in 025 to be explicated by the following.
You mean 25.1?
No. Well... Oh, yeah, okay. That form is then explained in 251.
Right.
Let's just focus on color for the moment. The form would be that it has some color. The content would be it's blue. That's how I would take that. And that every concrete object would have to have both its form, it has a color, as well as some content to it.
Yeah, but substance is what exists independently of what is the case. And what is the case is that it is blue.
That's right. So
but that doesn't jive with... So it can't be that.
Well, because substance...
So content can't mean having a particular color. Because substance is form and content. And if content is having a particular color, a substance has a particular color.
I wonder if 027 sheds any light on this. And he kind of, his punchline seems to be objects, the unalterable and the subsistent are one and the same.
Read your translation again?
Of 027?
Yeah.
It says, objects, the unalterable and the subsistent are one and the same.
Mine reads, the fixed, the existent, and the object are one. The object is the fixed, the existent. Configuration is changing, the variable. Configuration of the objects form the atomic facts. The atomic facts, in the atomic fact, objects hang one in the other, like the length of a chain. In the atomic fact, the objects are combined in a definite way. The way in which objects hang together in the atomic fact is the structure of the atomic fact.
Well, the word that's causing trouble is content in 2025, right?
Right.
I mean, that's really everything hangs on what that means.
Yeah, if you just scrap that word, then everything...
Right.
Everything goes.
But he never gave an independent definition of what he means by content.
Right, my argument was that it can't be external relations, of course.
But it also can't be the concrete specificity of a blue object here at this time. So, I wonder if...
That's why I'm reading it as object. It is form and object.
Well, I'm wondering if form and content is meant not to be two different things, but just a... what do they call that?
Autonomy?
A duality or something. Two words are saying the same thing. I'm sick and tired kind of expression.
Yeah, I can't believe it because I would do that though.
Why would he waste a whole other level of 2.02?
Does he mention content at all before? I don't remember.
I don't recall content ever being mentioned. Nor do I see it in the several sentences following. Why don't we finish down to 2.1 and then go back and see if... Why don't we bracket and content?
Well, I'm looking to the German to see if there's any...
Oh, okay.
Amounts for content.
Yeah, I'm scanning it. I don't see this particular issue being discussed at all. I mean, I read you the whole section that takes us through 2.1. Or, I mean, it takes us to 2.1. What's the German for the word content?
Inhalt.
Inhalt.
Yeah, that I'm looking. I looked before, now after. I don't see it anywhere. It may be just a unnecessary redundancy. But I mean, think about it though. I mean, what? I mean, form and content. I mean, they don't mean the same thing. I mean, you can't. It'd be hard to believe that he meant it the way you explained it, because it is form and structure. I mean, you can understand that, but form and content.
And what's the antecedent in 2.025? Or what's the whole German sentence?
Sie ist form und Inhalt. Well, since he doesn't use it several pages after, we probably best to ignore it for now.
I'm going to make a notation here in my text that this is a problematic...
Here's the next time I see it. Der Inhalt des Satzes, the content of the proposition, means the content of the significant proposition. In the proposition, the form of its sense is contained, but not its content. As in the proposition there.
What's the number on that one?
3.
Well, you jumped way ahead. How'd you get that far ahead?
I just glossed it looking for the word. Yeah, listen to this. In the proposition, now it's talking about something different. It's not talking about substance. But in the proposition, the form of its sense, in the same word, the form of its sense is contained, but not its content. So in the proposition, the form is not its content. So he clearly, in terms of proposition, distinguishes between form and content. But in substance, so I mean, just by that exegesis, it seems like doesn't mean the same thing by them. He clearly distinguishes between the two.
Does Elizabeth have a verse by verse?
No, it's kind of a... It takes a very different tack altogether. She goes to the main, has a different chapter on some of the main themes of the Tractatus. But it's, you know, goes through the whole, you know, book in each chapter.
Thematically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's jot that down. So we'll just read it for now as it is formed.
I wonder if he's just simply emphasizing the fact that to have the form of having a color entails that it in fact has some color. So in other words, you can't have the form of having a color unless you also have a content. But it's not that content defines the substance, but just that it has a content.
Well, and that's another way, I think that's another way of saying that it is an object.
Yeah, and later he's going to say that the object, substance, and permanence are the same.
Right. So you have, if you read it as it is form and object, if substance is form and object, then you read the next one. Space, time, and color are forms of objects. So it's clear that it makes a distinction. So forms and objects. Then he says, objects are colorless.
I'm not saying that content means object. I'm saying that objects have form and contact. Content. Objects are substance. Because in 027, he makes this grand identification. Now, my translation there uses the word subsistent, not substance. The subsistent.
Yeah, in the German it's das Feste. Das Feste.
Oh, you're kidding. So that's not the same as substance. I think.
Well, my translation says Festus fixed.
Yeah, that would be more literal. Right.
The fast.
Well, what does he say for... Maybe the Das Feste is translated by unalterable in mine. What are the three nominatives in 027?
Beste Fende and Gegenstand.
What's the first one?
Beste Fende. B-E-S-T-E-H-E-N-D-A. E-N-D-E.
Oh, Bestehende. Okay, so Bestehende would be... It's besteht aus means that it consists of. But das Bestehende would be. He's almost getting a little bit Heideggerian, it seems like, in his use of language here.
Yeah, it's frighteningly sloppy.
I think Das Feste is the one that's translated as the unalterable in my translation.
Right.
And Das Bestehende must be the one that he gives as the subsistence, the subsistent.
So read yours again.
Objects, the unalterable, and the subsistence are one and the same. So objects are Gegenstände. Bestehende. Now, when he used the word substance on the earlier sentences, that was not Vishtanda, right?
No, substance.
It was just more like the tapping into the philosophical tradition of substance.
Right. Whatever the case, object and substance are identical.
Well, that's, we're not quite sure about that yet, right?
Well, he says in 24, substance is what exists independently of what is the case. In the 27, affix the existent and the object are one. So he's already, substance is what exists. So substance and objects are one. But he does not use the same word. The object is the fixed, existent. Configuration is a changing variable. Okay, what was your plan, to go down to where and then go back?
Oh, down to, but not including 2.1. In other words, go down through 063.
When which objects hang together and the atomic fact is the structure of the atomic fact. So you can see he's setting up his picture theory here. The form is the possibility of the structure. I'm not sure what that means. The form
Well, I think that's recapitulating his earlier statement. That all the possibilities are written into the object.
The structure of the fact consists of the structures of the atomic fact, right? The totality of existing atomic facts is the world. explain that totality of existence totality facts only determines what totality facts do not exist.
Well, no, that's a new level. It's 205.
Right. But it follows from 204. In other words, he's saying that all true propositions picture atomic facts, and then all the true propositions determines which propositions determine that fault, that other propositions are false. Existence of non-existence of atomic facts is reality. Yeah, I mean, what work is he doing here? This seems to be... Existence of non-existence of atomic facts is reality. Right, odd way of saying it, but makes, given how he's setting it up, follows the existence of atomic facts. They also call a positive fact, their non-existence, a negative fact. So, let me just translate this proposition talk. True propositions picture the world, false propositions do not. Atomic facts are independent of one another.
Well, I think the positive and negative is simply saying that it's not enough to say that there are a million horses that are alive right now in the world, you would also have to say, and there are no unicorns. So in other words, you haven't captured reality unless you can both specify what's true and also what's false. So in other words, a partial description would not be a description of reality. To say that you've described reality, it must be a complete description, both what everything that is and everything that is not. That's how I would interpret that. Reality is a comprehensive term, in other words, for him. Bit of idealism sneaking in. But then if you go back to 024, now I'm even more confused. Substance is what subsists independently of what is the case.
Well, why there? Because it's the atomic facts that... exist determine what is the case. And the atomic facts are consist of objects.
But objects and substance are the same, I thought, but maybe not. Objects and subsist and the Bestanda are one and the same, but not substance.
Well, where, I don't understand your problem at that at this point.
Well, maybe the more general way to make my complaint is, why this excursus on substance at all? What is this really adding to the... Unless it's just saying the same thing as his theory of all potential relations being written into an object.
And that, yeah, I mean, it could be what you said before, just tying in with the metaphysical tradition. Fellas, you want to know what substance is? Here it is. None of this Aristotelian mumbo-jumbo.
You have to have substance, so he's not an anti-substantialist, but he's kind of decoupling it from...
from reality, from the world. Substances make certain states of affairs possible, but they don't determine the states of affairs.
It seems to be the, again, you go back to the logical field, substance is just the reality that corresponds, all the potential reality that corresponds to the logical field, but not yet specified. Could be red, could be blue, we don't know what it is, but just that it must be some color is the substance. That it must be hard or soft. That it must be this, that, and the other thing.
Which is to be an object.
Right. It kind of reminds me of that when we did that metaphysics class, you know, the textbook writers kind of critiqued the notion of substance on the grounds that you're not really left with anything. When you say that there's this substance, this propertyless substance is... Remember, there was one school of metaphysicians that tried to avoid the notion of substance by speaking of bundles of properties.
Right.
And Wittgenstein seems to be saying, in that discussion, he would seem to have to say...
You on the right direction, but...
Yeah. In other words, what do you mean when you say bundles of properties? Well, you're... Already you have a form there. There has to be an object that could be this or could be that. You can't just have objectless properties, which when bundled form objects. Or maybe he's trying to avoid that. Like, you don't need to make that decision. I think that by affirming a notion of substance, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he would be rejecting the bundles of property.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, but he could... He would think that's going the right direction, only to get... But you're still going to end... They're right insofar as... No, they've got... These guys got... Our substance metaphysicians got it all wrong. So the criticism is in the right direction, but it still leaves you with something. It's just not what they call the substance.
And the substance is... the objects that have written into them the possibility of having relations and having color. But that substance is the same regardless of the color or the relation that might prove to be the case. So It's the same substance in many different possible worlds. This, the red apple in this in our world and the golden apple in some other world is the same substance of apple.
Well, the same logical space.
Which has the form, and the form is it has spatial and temporal position and having a color.
So to bring your discussion back to Plato, yeah, Plato's right in one sense, but totally misguided. The form isn't anything concrete like Plato said it was.
Yeah, in other words, Plato has tried to avoid the concrete by positing the form, the real form, which when concretized becomes a shadow of the form. Whereas Wittgenstein would not say it's a shadow, that there is no object that has no content. Maybe that's why he says the substance is form and content. There is no Platonic form, but yet, in one sense, it's logically, the logic does not determine its content, except that it has a content. Interesting.
Then he ends it by saying that total reality is the world.
Was there any more of that pie left? Or did we kill it?
Maybe, I'm not sure.
I feel the need for some nutrition. Do we have any crackers and cheese, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Well, I know there's cheese. There'd be crackers.
There's some Ritz crackers, but I don't know if she's saving those for some future occasion. There's two boxes of Ritz crackers up there.
Well, go ahead. She's always saving them for something. But
you want a few?
No.
Which way was it? You don't want anything? No, I don't know what time it is. But my telephone will tell us what time it is. Great. Yeah. That should really be our cutoff point. We only got to 2.1.
Shoot. Well, what we're going to have to do is work through this. I think the better plan is to jot down all the questions, try to get the forest for the trees, and then come back and do the detailed reading.
Mm-hmm. In other words, just plow ahead. We'll make marginal notes for it.
Right. I mean, we're going to have the first one just going to give us, hopefully, the causes to get not only the drift, but know where to ask the right questions when we come back. And
yeah, at this point, I only feel confident that I know kind of what field of inquiry he's taking a stab at, but I'm not totally precisely sure exactly what his answer is. I mean, I kind of know what question he's trying to answer, but I'm not perfectly clear what his answer is.
Well, I think one thing we need to keep in mind, too, is that, I mean, to him, his theory of meaning and is his theory of metaphysics, but he's getting to lay in his groundwork in metaphysics to get to his theory of meaning. I mean, he could have structured it with his theory of meaning first and then come down to this. I mean, it's just a matter of, but he's preparing the field, but that's what he's interested in.
Zen and Bodojan? Previous Zen and Bodojan?
No, well, it's theory of meaning. I mean, what is it for a proposition to be true? And the metaphysics is going to fill in the fill in the answer for him. So in other words, it's not a metaphysical inquiry, it's an inquiry into language that, I mean, I'm getting the impression from this that, this is preparing us for his agenda. This is not his agenda.
Right. So, I mean, the bottom line is going to be, I think, the logical constants. What are the logical constants mapping to? And they're going to be mapping to the atomic fact. And then, to get complex descriptors, you're going to need to use conjunction and disjunction. Get a properly formed proposition. So, the ABC, small a, small b, small c, logical constants, are going to map to these atomic facts. Or no, the objects are going to map to the atomic objects. And the atomic facts are going to be the mapping to the propositions that use those atomic constants. And then the form is going to be mapped to the universal form of propositions. All x, for all x, if a of x implies b of x. Things like that, I think.
And it mounts, if this is really what the amount seemed to imply, that this was, with Wittgenstein, the notion of an object, was something that he never gave an example of. Didn't he give the impression that that was the main confusion of the Tractatus?
No, I don't think he's saying that's the main confusion as much as, I mean, Mount seemed to be defending that lack of ability to give the example.
Yeah, but in the process, in defending it, he was saying that Wittgenstein ultimately thought it was a confused notion. I took from what he said, I'm going to have to read it again, but that he found that this was that not being able to give an example really is a fatal flaw in his whole picture theory.
I took it more that the atomic fact is an inescapable notion that you're driven to by giving sense to a system of propositions.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Wittgenstein abandons that later on completely. And so I guess my question is that, is it by simple virtue of the fact that he isn't being able to, because if it's all a matter of analysis, then you should be able to drive all the way to that point.
And resolve it?
Right.
Once and for all?
Right. I mean, because you could say things like G.E. Moore, that, well, good is unanalyzable. Well, so that just cuts off any, well, what is goodness then? Well, no, I mean, it's like being colored. I mean, you can't go beyond that. But at least he gives us something. I mean, if it's everything's analyzable to a certain point, then it's not fair to then ask, well, what is that? But if you're saying everything is analyzable to simples, then, but you can't get down to those, then it's not like, well, here's our simple, we just can't explain it, it's just a simple. But Wittgenstein hasn't got that. That is down there. he has given us something like a transcendental argument that there must be one. But see, that doesn't really work, because if you can never analyze down to that, then your analysis doesn't work at all.
In other words, if you can't show that necessity of there being a simple?
Well, he thinks he's shown the necessity of there being a simple, but he hasn't shown what the simple is.
But
that's like saying there must be a fundamental particle, or to say that, well, it's not going to work. There must be a fundamental ethical term, but I can't give an example. There must be fundamental ethical terms, but I can't give an example of one. But there must be, for, you know, provide a transcendental argument there. Okay, well then, what are they? Well, I don't know. I can't give an example of one.
Well, I mean, I could imagine the Tractatus trying to argue transcendentally that there must be these simples without having to give an example, but that the reason you can't give an example is because language is already embedded in the complexity. So the minute you try to form a sentence that says, well, okay, I'll give you an example. This is a simple. The this doesn't give any content, because it's just ostensive, you know, or pointing or something like that. So you have to use a description, but any description you would use is already complex. I mean, maybe that's kind of what drove him to his later ideas, as being that the language has this richness to it, and no matter where you dig down, you're dragging a lot of stuff with it, and you're never going to be able to describe the simple. In other words, I don't think that his later, this is a very naive view, but I don't think his later work would necessarily be a denial or refutation of his earlier work. It's almost like the earlier work maybe drove him to that. In other words, there are simples, but we can't ever describe them in our language because of our embeddedness. And so then he kind of took a different tack. Let's explore the richness of the embeddedness and not try to dig to the primary simple. Let's live the richness, so to speak. So in other words, it's kind of like a different project, but not necessarily one that overthrows the earlier project.
Well, the only thing is that if he's building up a theory of meaning, and on the basis of it is these propositions picturing these facts, but we can never have simple propositions because of this, and the complexity of language.
Well, I mean, could he say that we have propositions that function as if they were simple, even though they probably will always be criticizable as having hidden complexity. Yet we know that at bottom there's this metaphysical structure that must be simple, even if we can never reach it. We can never identify a proposition that's truly simple. But as a limiting concept, it still has validity. The insight still has validity. I mean, could you go that way?
Well, but it's more than a limiting concept. It's the basis of all of our propositions. I mean, so it seems like we should be able to, by unpeeling, eventually get there. Because if the complex propositions are built on these simple propositions, then can you say you could understand the complex propositions without ever having any comprehension of the simple knowledge that what the simple constituents are.
Well, I mean, I guess I would take that the, let's say a two-place logical operator, you know, a of x comma y. Now you substitute for x and y two logical constants, little a and little b. So little a relates to b by the relationship capital A. Or would it be a function, capital F, I guess. That formally is a simple proposition. If you could attach little a and little b to simple objects. Now we can't in reality, but we can still now discuss the logical, what it means to say a, f of a comma b, and then unpack how you can build complex logical judgments from that with conjunction and disjunction and implication.
Well, yeah, but he's not just trying to explain the relations and how those work. He's trying to explain, you know, how language, how the propositions get off the ground. In other words, this is not a logical account.
Well, maybe it is. Yeah. Why do you say it's not? Because later on he's going to get into quite a bit of the technicalities of, you know, how you construct a complex proposition from a simple one. Remember that single operator that he loves so much? The negation of the conjunction or whatever it is? They seem to take quite a shine to the idea of finding a universal form for all the logical assertions. It's that marker, I forgot what it's called, the Hahn marker or whatever it is, which is not the conjunction of A, B, and C, dot, dot, dot. Remember how the early systematic or symbolic logicians seem to take a shine to that? The idea that you could derive all of the different forms from that one operator?
Right. What was the Schlift mark?
Yeah, something like that. So now if he's got the idea that we know what it means to assign a logical constant, that means you assign it to an atomic object by naming. Now you build up the relations with logical operators, and then all possible relationships are buildable from the shift mark applied to all of your logical constants. So, I mean, it has kind of a nice feeling about it, right? It's kind of a very simple way that you've now displayed the entire logical field. And now if you could just go back and...
But he wants to bring some epistemology. He wants to say that we can have a true description of the world. He's told us how we can have it, but he has never, if that's the case, he's never showed us what that is.
Well, of course, don't forget his, what we've discussed before us, his real punchline, is that if you could, you still haven't really said much of anything that's important. I mean, I think that's the real punchline of the Tractatus.
Right, but I'm still at the point of, well, can you even do that?
Well, I think...
He seems to think that you can, and I don't think just by explaining logical form, he's given us how you can, but he hasn't explained that we can. But I think he thinks he's done that. I think he thinks he's solved that question. And say, look how meager it is. But my question is, when explaining how we could do it and explaining that we have done it are two different things.
I mean, could we say that he's proposing that he has shown what it means to give a complete logical description of the world, even if some of that is transcendental? In other words, it must be the case because of the impossibility of, if it weren't this way, we wouldn't have any link between propositions in the world, and therefore we'd be babbling nonsense. And other arguments, such as to show that is what you're doing when you do logic, even though you may never get the completeness. But even if you did carry the project out, you still missed everything important. So in other words, it seems to me, in terms of his punchline, it's not important to actually get down to the dirty business of assigning the logical constants and making a list of all the propositions that describe the world.
Yeah, but he's right on board with the logical positivists in terms of their basic metaphysics.
Well, yes and no. I mean, logical positivists were horrified, like that cartoon that I described to you, Joe. They were horrified and beating their breasts when they discovered the mystical element in Wittgenstein. So, I mean, that he really wasn't
right
supporting them. He was almost, in a way, showing how impoverished they were.
Right, but he was saying that, yeah, this is all we can say.
Right, but by all he can say, I think he's kind of playing on Zagan and Zotz, or Zotz's proposition. In other words, he obviously said a lot about ethics and aesthetics and these other things. I mean, so he didn't mean that literally.
No, no, but I mean, you're taking me the other way. My take on Wittgenstein is that, yeah, you guys have said everything that can be said, or at least you're in the right direction, but that's meager.
But I think he's using said in a kind of a rarefied sense there.
Well, right, I mean, but that's not my, whatever you mean, plug it in, but still he thinks there's something, their description of the world is a full description in terms of what is meaningful.
But only in the propositional sense.
In the propositional sense, right. Not in the importance.
In other words, you can't convert the experience of listening to Beethoven's Fifth to a sequence of propositions, and therefore you can't say, quote-unquote, anything about the experience of Beethoven's Fifth, but yet you can talk about it.
Right.
You can share the experience with somebody and talk about it.
Right, but, yeah, I mean, let's grant all that, but I'm saying that what you can say propositionally
would map to what the logical
talk they said.
Right. Exactly.
So he's not just given a mere logical description, but there's a metaphysics there as well. In other words, I don't think you could say what you said earlier that, well, he's just giving us how you can do it. I think he thinks it's actually in this book actually been done, or at least just the details need to be worked out. But maybe you're right about that. I don't know. That hasn't been my take on him. Yeah, it's too bad we don't have a Wittgenstein scholar, too. But maybe we come into it fresh like this and struggling through it will give us insights that we would be ruined if we...
Well, exactly. I mean, the scholars have their blind spots and their ruts that they're in from a very early age, too. And of course, we do have great mystery scholars with us in the form of Elizabeth and Mounts and others.
I meant more somebody that could take us,
lead us by the hand more.
Yeah, hand, but
answer our specific questions.
Yeah, no,
that's not what Wittgenstein meant.
Go verse by verse.
Right. But more and more, I'm beginning to think that such a scholar doesn't exist. I mean, I think there's a reason why Mounts and Elizabeth kind of paint in very broad brushstrokes. I'm not sure that they would be able to say, well, 2.025 means this, definitely. I think that they seems like they too are left with this kind of gestalt. You know, it seems like it's this. Consider this line of thinking that Wittgenstein is probably opening up. Otherwise, why wouldn't there be a book that would give it to you, verse-by-verse exegesis?
Maybe there is.
Well, we can keep looking, but if there is, I'm sure a Google search should show it up. I haven't found it yet.
Well, for Monday, then, we should at least get to
through chapter 3?
Yeah, at least to chapter 3. Well, we should be able to get through, if we kind of get, yeah, the longer as they go, so 3 isn't unreasonable. That only takes us less than...
Well, I think we should be able to get through 3.
Yeah, that only takes us 25 pages or so further.
And actually, some of the later sections might actually be easier, because some of it's just going to repeat some stuff we've studied with the symbolic logic and probability theory and things like that. I mean, I'm almost guessing that chapter 1 will end up being the most enigmatic when all the dust finally settles. I mean, unpacking what he means by some of the symbolism might be tricky, but I don't think it's in principle difficult.
No.
I mean, it's at exactly that point that there shouldn't be any controversy.
Right. When you plug into it.
Yeah. In fact, with a little bit of luck, we could probably slug all the way through chapter 4. Because 5.101 gives all the different propositional atomics coming from the chef mark. So without having to go through each one by one laboriously, we know, that's what he's trying to do. Let's move on to the next section. I mean, I just feel that this is far richer than anything the logical positivists ever dished up. You know, it's just like worthwhile where they often aren't. That's why that cartoon is so great. It shows these guys like in catatonic state, like, oh no.
Yeah, he did all that we could and bet more so, and yet. Yeah, there's no content here in the index. There's no entry for content.
Well, on our second reading, we should probably just try to do it all with the German.
Yeah, well, I need to get the I need to have my dictionary handy. Although his vocabulary isn't too too vast.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, since you're trying to, you know, come up on your German also, you might take this as the text you're going to work through. Look up every single word. I mean, I'll bet you there wouldn't be more than 500 words you need to add to your vocab list. That's the neat thing about being a niche reader. You can get it, you know, in its entirety. Then you pick up Goethe, you know, and it's like, what on earth is he talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is a particularly easy one, but well, Zeit und Farbe sind Formen der Gegenstände. I know what that means. I didn't know Farbe is color, but now I do. So room or space, time and color are, it is the form of the object. Yeah, that would be a good exercise.
Yeah, it would, because that's how you...
Only in my grammar.
Exactly. Because, I mean, that is the only way, as I indicated in one of the comments, that is the only way to master the reading of a language, simply to slug through a work from beginning to end and basically get every word.
Well, then let's continue on 2.1.
Yeah, that should go faster, at least for a while, because we've already discussed the picture model.
Well, then that means let's get to bed early tomorrow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we could maybe get a...
Polish off some before and or during some of the risk.
Yeah, we could do... Well, we should probably do risk in the morning, try to get a quickie in, and then just go head to my office.
Oh, yeah.
But we have to take this with us.
Right. That would make all the difference. You know what you ought to do is invest in a couple more of these. Keep one up in that porch all the time, keep one down here, and keep one in your office.
Yeah, they're only... We could just stop off at... I hate to buy another one because we're moving, but, you know, for 6 months... Or at least for the rest of the winter.
How much does one of these machines cost?
That one was $30-some.
That's not much.
Yeah. Well, it's worth it for...
Do they have one with a little more BTUs than this?
No, they have about all the same. Mm-hmm. But if you get it going, it's just a function of time. You know, just...
As long as you're insulated, as long as you don't have your window gaping open like you do in the summer.
Right, so just if we could... I could go run up and get one. You could set up the game, and I could go to the office and plug it in and get some head start.
Well, we don't need that.
We could go to Starbucks. Well, yeah, we could find some place.
Or even the Barnes & Noble right here.
Oh, yeah. Or the Barnes & Noble.
That's even walkable. We could even make a few trips there. Make an hour trip, come back for a game, make another hour trip. Or spend an hour at Barnes & Noble while we're waiting for the office to heat up. You know, lots of variations.
Yeah, well, let's just do... We can... The other Barnes & Noble, there's more comfortable chairs that you can sit down and hang out. And it's bigger. That one, you feel a bit conspicuous to spend.
This one has comfy chairs. I saw through the window, but not very many, so they might be occupied. But I saw some people hanging around on comfy chairs, it looked like. But it's small, so, that, you know, three students showing up.
But I've seen, but at Starbucks, too, I've seen people hanging out there with books and...
Oh, yeah.
So that's, I guess that's
part of the culture there.
But it's not turning tables.
it's you'd feel awkward if there was a big rush of people and people are standing around like looking for tables, you know, and you're sitting there. But that's, you know, a psychological problem more than anything else.
Okay, well, let's do that. We'll go to a Starbucks or Barnes & Noble or something like that.
Or if it's a little warmer, you know, maybe the heater would be enough. And also, you hadn't brought a jacket. You were wearing your shorts. I mean, if we started off bundled up.
Well, I think with all the office is so big and that there's a big desk between us, I think in a Starbucks setting it'd be actually. So all I have to do is go pick up my Duden, and that would be sufficient. So we need the Tractatus and the dictionary.
Well, for the first reading, we don't need to. I mean, my knowledge of the German would be sufficient for the first reading when we need to consult. I'd like to see what Duden says about Inhalt, whether that's exactly what we commonly mean by content. It might have to do with more of like the interior structure. Inhalt, held in. But when we're looking for nuances, that's where, you know, I do need a dictionary occasionally. But you know, the basic, at the level that we're at right now, I can usually get enough in the German there.
Okay. Oh, good. Yeah, we're going to have, so what we'll do on Monday, now that we're a few nights into your trip finally, we'll just plan on risk in the morning and have a cutoff time, like till no later than lunch.
Or if we, by some miracle, beat the monsters up. You know, we can squeeze some in before the rest of them.
I don't believe in miracles.
Metaphysical impossibility.
We're living beyond the age of miracles now. I'd just be happy if we started a game by a little before 10.
Yeah.
You know, breakfast and.
I can't understand how your monsters have so much energy. I mean, they obviously don't fall asleep for a couple hours after they go to bed, and yet they still spring up. I mean, they never seem to want to just sleep in till 10 o'clock.
No, they never want to sleep in. Especially, Gregory would more, but they all wake, you know, they wake each other up. Gregory was the one that slept in the most.
Which one springs to life the first?
Audrey, when she was in, I think Tommy used to always wake Audrey up when they were together, so probably Tommy or Robbie.
It's a younger, ripples up, domino
yeah,
effect.
Yeah, mainly probably Tommy, because he gets a nap.
Right.
And so he needs a nap, and yet he probably doesn't need as much sleep.
Well, maybe Julie could yank him out of the room in the morning and set him up in her room.
No, she wants her. She gets up early and gets ready and has to be, you know, once the baby's up, it's amazing.
Game is over.
Yeah, he's up. He's not, you know, coming to mommy's bed. And there's no none of that. He's awake and it's time to go.
Yeah, the only thing is this pushes my return trip out either to late Monday or even spilling into Tuesday, which is
well, what's the problem with that?
Well, it's dicey, because then I need to recover from the trip and get back to work.
Well, let's make a pact, then. Tomorrow it's 10 o'clock, lights out.
And I would drive back on Monday evening?
Well, I mean, whatever, but the point is, if we all get to bed early Monday, tomorrow night, and we get 10 hours of sleep, 11 hours of sleep, and that's going to go a long way. And if you spend Monday night, we can say, okay, well, we'll do Wittgenstein in the day. We'll do an opera or a movie in the night. We'll probably, you know, if we spend 6 hours on Wittgenstein, we'll probably, you know, it's, and then we can cut it off at 1:30, you know, just have a, we'll shoot for one, but this is the drop, you know, and that way. So if we get to bed at 1, then, you know, you'll get up, probably leave at, have, you know, 9, 10, but you'll have another decent night's sleep. So in other words, you'll have some time to recover from me. But it all is key. We got to go to bed early tomorrow night. Since if we do this, I don't know about you, but for me, if I get a good night's sleep tomorrow night, then I'll be good to go.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, even getting to bed at 1 is a huge help. So getting to bed before 11 would be...
Oh, yeah. No question.
So, I mean, I don't think you'll be all racked up whenever you get back if we do that.
Yeah, and every page of Wittgenstein that we can do justifies almost another day.
Yeah, well, let's get to bed now and try to do.